The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 95, recorded January 25th, 2013. MLA, AHA, and Aaron Swartz. Well, welcome back to another episode of Digital Campus. I'm Tom Scheinfeld at Found History. It's episode 95. We're getting awful close to that century mark. It's only taken us, what, 5 years? But for a bi-weekly podcast, that's it's pretty sad.
In name only.
In name only. But we're going to keep
a,
that.
A better than monthly tag. Podcast.
Right. Those voices you hear are two of the old timers. Dan Cohen. Hey, Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Dan is at Dan Cohen and dancohen.org. And Mills Kelly. Hey, Mills.
How's it going, Tom?
That's Mills Kelly at Edwired Mills on Twitter and edwired.org on the website. And we've also got our third regular here, Amanda French. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Tom.
And that's Amanda French on Twitter and amandafrench.net on the web. And we're very lucky to be joined. I can't even believe this. For the first time, it's hard to believe in 5 years we haven't had her on, but our good friend Kathleen Fitzpatrick. Hi, Kathleen.
Hey, Tom.
And Kathleen, give us your deets. Where can we find you on the web?
You can find me at kfitz on Twitter, and you can find me at plannedobsolescence.net on the broader internet.
Great. And for those of you who don't know, Kathleen is Director of Scholarly Communications. Did I get that right?
Yes.
At the Modern Languages Association. Very conveniently, in fact, because this is going to be our roundup show of the big conferences that happened earlier in the month. We're going to talk a little bit about digital goings-on at the MLA, which was in Boston, and the AHA, which was in New Orleans. And we've got very lucky to have people who went to both of those meetings and who are really very involved in both of those meetings with us today. So let's kick it off, Kathleen, first with the MLA. From your perspective, working there, how did you think it went, and how did you think digital was represented at the meeting?
I thought it was a brilliant convention, and I'm not just saying that because they pay me to do so. I thought it was really quite amazing, both for the energy and the quality of the conversations that were taking place. As you know, Mark Sample has been for the last, oh gosh, I don't even know how many years now, putting together an annual list of all of the digital humanities / digital media sessions that are taking place at the convention. And it, every year it's increased, right? Those conversations have been spreading. And this year, I think the quality of those conversations was really pretty extraordinary.
And Amanda, you were there too, right?
Yes, I was. Sorry, I had to unmute my microphone. But yes, I was at MLA, and I have to say that MLA sucked me in this year. I didn't even mean to stay for the whole thing, and then I wound up staying for the whole thing. And I had a great time, but then I've been having a great time at it for probably the last 3 years. So I've been having a great time at MLA even before it was fashionable to have a great time at MLA.
and in terms of the distribution of the digital conversations, were these mostly digital conversations about I guess were they meta conversations, or were they conversations about digital research? So I guess what I'm saying is, are these conversations about digital humanities research that are going on, where people are presenting digital research, or are they mostly conversations about the changing landscape of scholarship and you know, advancing the digital humanities, et cetera?
My sense is that, you know, there remains a both of those things going on, right? There is a fair bit of meta conversation about what the digital is, what the digital humanities might be, how it might function, digital humanities pro or con, et cetera. You know, all of that stuff is still very much present. But at the same time, I think we're seeing an increasing presence for the actual digital work, and not just stuff that is explicitly identifying as digital humanities, but stuff that is out in the subfields within the broader organization that's nonetheless bringing digital methods to bear on the kinds of work that scholars at the MLA are doing. Do you have that same sense, Amanda?
I think that's fair. Probably if I had to pick one or the other, I would say that many of the conversations were still slightly meta conversations about digital humanities as an endeavor, or about sort of slightly meta issues like scholarly publishing. But Kathleen is right that there definitely were sort of digital sub fields represented. There was a panel on digital bibliography, for instance, that I went to, which has, of course, particular pertinence to people at the MLA who produce a very famous bibliography. Certainly there were people who were talking about the work they do in their subfields, presenting, you know, talking about digital projects they were doing. I'm thinking about Michael Elliott in particular, who was talking about his work with rhetorical figures in Shakespeare, and talking about, you know, using digital methods to kind of analyze those. So yes, I think that's fair to say that there were both sort of methodological and case study types of presentations there.
Absolutely. And there was a really great pre-conference workshop that was held on digital pedagogy. It was sort of unconference style in its structure that Brian Croxall and Adeline Coe put together. And it did a fantastic job from everything I've heard. I didn't get to be at it, unfortunately. But from everything that I've heard, it did a really, really great job of getting people activated and excited about actual hands-on things that they can do in thinking about the digital in their classrooms.
That was my next question, is kind of things that stood out for both of you, you know, panels that you went to that seemed especially interesting, or people that you met that you hadn't met before that really blew your mind. I know, you know, we all come away from these things with a notebook full. Are there things from your notebooks that you can tell the audience about?
Well, sure. You know, I did meet Michael Elliott for the first time, and he said he's a digital campus fan. So hello out there to Michael, if you're listening.
Oh, very nice.
So that was exciting. You know, I met Ted Underwood for the first time. I had never met him before. I think I met Spencer Corrales for the first time. So, yeah, I met some people that I had known a little bit online and then met them for the first time. Some of these people I hadn't even known online and then did meet them. You know, I actually tweeted heavily, and I don't really know why this struck me so much, and it's only maybe vaguely under the big tent of digital humanities. But I went to a panel on dictionaries that kind of blew my mind. And I think I was, you know, one of the few people who was there from the sort of digital humanities as usual. But it was just sort of this thing where, you know, it's sort of a very obvious point that when, you know, dictionaries move into the digital realm, they become very different kinds of beasts than a print dictionary. But it was just kind of fascinating to hear from Peter Sokolowski at MW.com and some other people doing, you know, really kind of like web 2.0 or web 3.0 work with dictionaries, and to kind of realize that all of that has been going on and how important it is really for research and scholarship. I thought that was a kind of a fascinating panel. So
how about you, Kathleen? Anything that stood out? I mean, you were probably like incredibly busy at work the whole time, but
yeah, I was, sad to say, it was extremely exciting, but I was, because I was working both sides of the convention, both trying to go to stuff and also doing the work of scholarly communication there. found myself sort of split in what I was able to go see. But I will tell you that I was privileged enough to be part of a couple of panels that I thought were just really fantastic. Most notably, I think the last session of the last day was a session on the challenges and benefits of serial scholarship. It was put together by Mark Sample and Jason Mattel, and it included Ted Underwood, who I also got to meet, though I don't know if it's for the first time or not, but I was really thrilled to see him there. Doug Armato of University of Minnesota Press, and you know, several other really fantastic presentations. I thought it produced a really interesting discussion and actually kept people involved and invested right up until the bitter end of the convention. So,
yeah, I went to that panel and it was, you know, it was a little bit of a good angel, bad angel sort of thing. You're like, oh, I'm really tired. I've been conferencing for so long, but I do want to see it. And yeah, I was really glad I did because that was a terrific panel.
And one of the things that you know, watching the MLA from afar, that I noticed over Twitter were lots of links to the Commons. Presumably, we can find some conversations about some of these panels on the Commons. Kathleen, can you tell us a little bit about the new Commons and how it worked at the meeting and where you see it? Where you see it fitting into the MLA in the future?
Absolutely. I mean, we were really excited to be able to launch MLA Commons at the convention this year. We sort of emerged into open beta there and have a really pretty robust and growing group of MLA members who are involved now, you know, posting new material, creating blogs, creating groups, discussing with one another the things both that happened at the convention and the stuff that they're working on more generally in their scholarly lives. The Commons is running on top of Commons in a Box software, which, as you know, the CUNY Academic Commons team built with support from the Sloan Foundation. We did our modifications to MLA Commons with support from Mellon, and we're really, really thrilled to have this space now in which, you know, our members are going to be able to help us really rethink how it is that scholars are communicating with one another, what kinds of connections they want to create with one another, and what kinds of work we're doing in these new open digital spaces. So we're extremely excited about it and, you know, seem to have some pretty good buy-in so far. You know, this is not to say that we don't have a lot of work yet to do on the platform. We do, and, you know, we're still actively trying to make it better and think about the new features that we want to roll out ahead. But we're extremely excited about where we are today.
It's great. I mean, as I said, it was fun to watch sort of the Commons with its launch kind of start being populated and links start going out. So that was very cool. Dan and Mills, are you hearing similar things to what you experienced at AHA in New Orleans? You think maybe I'll pose the same question to you. You know, were the digital panels and the digital conversations going on in New Orleans, were they mostly those meta conversations about the role of the digital and the future of the digital, or were they presentations of actual digital work?
I saw a lot of presentations of actual digital work, which was really encouraging to me because many of these were, you know, work that's been developing over a number of years. I was on a panel about digital projects around New Orleans and Cleveland, and engaging the public with the digital work, which was really fantastic. I think I was probably the least interesting of all of the presenters. And then you know, there was a fair amount on work that people have been doing with GIS, which they've been doing for 3 or 4 years now, and so it's much more mature versions of the scholarship, and so that was really exciting for me. Dan?
I would agree with that. I mean, I thought it was really striking when Kathleen said that there was a kind of, I don't know if normalization would be the right word for it, but sort of integration into subfields that probably wouldn't consider themselves digital at heart. And I saw the same thing. Like Mark Sample, I usually try to blog a list of the panels that have DH kinds of stuff, digital humanities kinds of stuff at the AHA. And the list grew again this year very significantly. But I think more importantly, unlike last year where there were some, you know, meta or kind of hand-wringing type panels. I think particularly there was a big panel last year in Chicago involving the Culturomics guys who had really like broken on the scene and where people were kind of wondering about text mining, a very aggressive form of text mining. This year there really wasn't a lot on text mining, but there was a lot of just regular panels, panel on oral history, I'm going to get this wrong. I think in Asian history, there was, something on medieval European history that, talked about, space and time and had a panelist working with GIS. So that there were just, you know, what I would call, you know, regular panels that had one or more scholars who, you know, had some digital methods on it. And so it was maybe a little bit less in your face than it was last year where, in fact, I think the overall theme of the AHA meeting last year was something about, you know, the digital age. And in fact, this year it was also about, history, and the public and being sort of involved with the public online. But most of the sessions were actually what I would consider kind of standard, mapping or oral history or, text-based kinds of things that involve digital methods. So for me that, I mean, you know, that strike me as maybe a healthy thing. I sort of tweeted something about that because when I was looking over at the MLA hashtag on Twitter, it seemed to me like there were a few panels that I think were kind of jammed in that maybe got a little bit more emotional on Twitter, I guess. Things about like the dark side of DH and things like that we didn't really have at the AHA meeting, with the exception of one panel I'll get to in just a second. And I sort of tweeted that, you know, well, it did seem like there was a little bit of a contrast between AHA and MLA. And a friend of the show, Matt Kirschenbaum, tweeted back that he said that the MLA could problematize our meeting for us if we'd like. So,
you know, the thing I noticed is compared to previous years is that the panels that I went to that had, you know, that had digital components to them, the presenters weren't saying, "Hey guys, look at this.
Yeah,
I got
right.
this computer and it'll let me," you know, there was none of that. It was completely normalized. And
And
so the digital wasn't the thing that they were the fact that I did it in a digital form wasn't what they were presenting. They were presenting the results of their work, which happened to be possible because they used digital means to get there.
To be honest, I wish we had a bit more of that at MLA, just because, you know, as I say, we do have a lot of great methods panels and sort of larger issue panels. And, I wouldn't mind seeing a little bit more. Hey, here's what I learned about 19th century fiction through my topic modeling of it, sort of thing.
Right.
But,
right.
The other thing that struck me at the AHA is what seemed to be a growing chasm between the scholars who produce the knowledge and the publishers who publish the knowledge over the issue of open access. And I mean, Dan was on a panel that got, you know, the audience was getting a little testy, and I would say even some of the participants in the panel were, I wouldn't say testy, but tense might be another word about it. And I think that there's, you know, I went to several panels about this, and I think that there's clearly a growing divide over this issue of open access, that the people who are making the work are really interested in open access, and the people who are publishing the work are not.
It's interesting, you know,
exactly
using that word making. I bet the people publishing the work would dispute your use of them, of the word making, of them not making it.
Right. On the panel I was on, they had the editor of the American Historical Review, Rob Schneider, you know, who's a great guy and I like him a lot. But I think you definitely saw the role of the journal, and he was pretty explicit about this, Mills, don't you think, in his talk about, you know, they play this really critical role, a kind of central role in the creation of scholarship and the vetting of it. excuse me. So that was a panel where I think things got a little bit, itchy, especially in the audience. It was surprising. We actually asked for people to raise their hands. And what struck me, I mean, Rob is really, you know, at the top of the profession in terms of editorial roles, since the AHR is, you know, the major journal, overall journal. But there were lots and lots. I mean, it was astonishing. Maybe half the audience were editors of smaller historical journals.
I think more than half. More like two-thirds.
Right. And, you know, and so these are journals with maybe they have, you know, these are scholars who are running it themselves. I mean, history professors with maybe a course release each semester to try to run a small journal in their subfield. And you know, my feeling on that was that the only thing they could really see was that their subscription base was being eroded by this notion of open access. And there was not a lot of creativity in the room thinking about other ways that they could be funded, even though I brought a few up, like New Mexico Historical Review, which has been around for almost a century, recently moved the editorial workflow folks and the editor into the library, and they're just paying the $70,000 a year cost and making it open access rather than trying to get the subscriptions for the journal. So I think Mills is right that it just felt like, well, maybe this is one of these like tough issues that remains. And I think in some ways the digital methods for research became very much normalized at the same time that the scholarly communication side of things became much more tense.
Were there parallel conversations? I'm sure there were going on at MLA. Kathleen, you must be aware of some of that.
I think there were some parallel conversations going on. They for whatever reason, were not going on around me. So I'm actually going to throw this one back to Amanda, who I think had something to say.
Actually, I was going to say that I didn't think that we did have much conversation about open access at MLA. I don't think I think that that's just sort of happenstance, or maybe certainly the panel you mentioned on serial scholarship addressed those issues kind of tangentially. But actually, somebody tweeted me during the conference asking if there were discussions of open access. And I had to say, I don't really think there are any this time. And I'm not sure why that was. I actually noticed in the Twitter conversation on the hashtag about AHA, didn't you have a keynote speaker that was Michael Pollan? Is that right? At AHA?
Yeah, there was a panel. He was, I think, on a panel about sort of the public writing of history.
Right. I saw a lot of people sort of saying, oh, here's someone telling us to write for the public and sort of not understanding, why we don't, And I thought that actually conversation, you know, from the limited amount I was able to see it on Twitter, was actually quite interesting and had ramifications for digital history because, as Tom has said in some other points, you know, public history these days is digital history. If you want to write for the public, one of the best places to do that is to do it online. So I thought that it was interesting that the notion of writing for the public seemed to be really in the air at AHA. And I actually, to be honest, I think that that's that specific thing, you know, that just impetus to write for a public is always a little bit less urgent for us at the MLA, just because it's not always clear that there is as much of a public for what we do.
Right. Or at least there isn't I always say that, like, there isn't really an identifiable discipline or sub-discipline that's like public lit crit in the way that there is public history, which has its own, you know, association, its own meeting, its own practitioners, its own tenured positions. There aren't people doing public lit crit in that way, although I think they're increasingly there with the kind of rise of public humanities programs. There is some of that going on, but it's not institutionalized in the same way that it is in history.
Well, you know, and I hasten to say, and Kathleen will probably, I'll let Kathleen say what she wants to say too, but I'll hasten to say that there have been, public literary criticism, in the history of literary criticism. I mean, you know, there was a whole time in the 50s where, reviewing literature was one of the main things that literary critics did. And the other thing is that there is a great deal of evidence that when you do make your literary criticism public these days, there are far more people interested in it than you ever thought there would be. So, for instance, Jason Mattel in that panel was talking about writing about television on Media Commons, and how, you know, what he was doing was drafting a book in public online, and yet that book was already being taught and cited and quoted in the New Yorker and things like that before it was being, before it was finished. So, so there is that. But I would even, you know, at the risk of having arrows shot at me, that I do think that there's not as innate a public interest in literary criticism as there is in history.
Kathleen go too.
Thanks. I was just going to say that I don't know if I would characterize the interest as being innate necessarily. I mean, as Tom says, there is a subfield within history that has been explicitly defined as public history for a long time. So there's a kind of institutional acceptance, if at times a begrudging one, of the idea that there is this thing that one can do called public history. And we've never really discussed literary criticism of a public nature as being something that one can prepare oneself for in grad school. But I think that's becoming increasingly pressing and increasingly viable as a topic for discussion for us to have. One of the other things that came out of this serial scholarship session, and this is actually something that I had talked about, is precisely why it is we find the idea of public literary criticism to be funny, right? That there's something in that notion that just doesn't seem to work for us, while at the same time we're in this new golden age, frankly, of public literary criticism, with publications like N+1 and The All and the Los Angeles Review of Books and so forth, that are really putting this incredible amount of energy into finding ways for people who care about literature to talk about it in a really pretty in-depth and open kind of way. So I think that, you know, we're right on the cusp of finding a way for this mode of public literary work to become more institutionally viable than it's been.
Well, and I think that's a big key difference, I think, in the way public historians think about their work than even in the way that it was from afar being presented at AHA. It's not so much, I mean, public historians think of their work not so much as writing history for the public, but they're much more interested in writing history with the public. And I think in that respect, there's a tremendous opportunity for public literary criticism, in conversations about literature. You could say like Oprah's book club is public lit crit in a way. And there are clearly tons of people interested in that. Before we go, move on too much further, I want to introduce a late arrival. We're really lucky to have Tim Carmody from The Verge join us. Tim's been on the show before. He is himself a scholar who writes for the public. Hey, Tim.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Can you guys hear me okay? I just turned on my microphone.
Yep.
All right, wonderful.
You sound great. thanks for coming on. But before we move on from AHA and MLA, one thing I'm just kind of interested in, and I don't know if I saw too much of it in the Twitter stream. I would be surprised if people weren't talking about MOOCs. Did we hear a lot about MOOCs at the meetings?
At the MLA, I personally heard one presentation from Kathy Davidson in one of the presidential forum sessions, talking about the ways that we need to sort of be thinking about these new ostensibly open modes of online education with a bit more rigor and a bit more sort of critical awareness of the kinds of inequities that they still continue to underlie, rather than sort of taking the utopian approach that so many critics have taken to this point and thinking about what those new kinds of educational systems can possibly do. So that's the one thing that I heard. Amanda, did you get to hear anything else?
We mentioned in passing that Dark Side of Digital Humanities panel, which I went to and was, you know, I was excited to hear about the Dark Side of Digital Humanities because there is one. But I didn't really hear it characterized very well there. And one of the things I found baffling was that at least a couple of the speakers, and I think three, sort of mentioned MOOCs in the context of the Dark Side of Digital Humanities. And I literally said in the discussion period afterward, I just don't know any digital humanists who are pro MOOC. So to call MOOCs digital humanities seems to me, you know, wrong to the point of absurdity. So I heard people talk about MOOCs in that context, for sure. I actually wanted to make a correction, too, in that I did look through the program to see if there were any other sessions on open access, and I did see a few, including one on Echo and Ebo, the early English books online and 18th century books online, and then another one on Beyond the PDF Experiments in Open Access Scholarly Publishing. So I think I just must have missed a couple of sessions on open access, but I don't think I missed any on MOOCs. I think I heard Kathy Davidson's talk too, and I heard people mention it in the Dark Side of Digital Humanities panel, but that was about it.
Well, these conference programs are put together so far in advance that MOOCs really didn't become the hot topic until, well, you're right, like middle of last year. So the proposals could have been in already. We may be hearing more about MOOCs next year. Did you guys hear about it, Dan and Mills, in New Orleans?
Well, you know, because the AHA is in New Orleans and New Orleans is such a fun place, they actually forbid the use of the word MOOC at all.
I forgot. We actually had a conversation about MOOCs at that camp MLA, which happened before MLA, and which is ad hoc. And it's one of the reasons why we put sessions together at the last minute, is you can talk about things that are timely. So we got to talk about MOOCs, and we talked a little bit about MIT's edX. A lot of it was just sort of, I don't know, venting, I guess you could say, and people talking about being asked to be on committees to determine what their university should do with regard to MOOCs. And I am very glad not to be on such a committee. But.
Well, it's difficult because on the one hand, there's nobody who's looked more at digital scholarship and digital pedagogy and digital resources in the humanities than digital humanists. So it would seem as though people in the digital humanities would be – if – for any kind of online education effort, and of course, you know, this goes back long before MOOCs, it would seem like there would be lots of things that digital humanists could contribute to such a committee. Even though, again, MOOCs are lame and totally not fun and not fit for New Orleans. I think I wonder, like, what, and I guess I'll ask you guys, because I'm sort of out of these, you know, I'm out of these fights now, like, what is the balance between sort of engaging with this discussion to try to steer it to a better place versus saying, that's not what digital humanities is, that's not what we're about, don't lump us in with that, we don't support this, et cetera.
Well, it's a great question. I think, Tim, as Amanda said, like the balance has, from the digital humanities community, the balance has been, the opinion has sort of been one of disengagement. You know, I don't think we have engaged with MOOCs as much as we probably should. It a lot of the energy in the MOOC movement that's happened over the last 6 months has, you know, as you said, it hasn't come from the digital humanities community. It came from elsewhere. And so I think, right, you know, we in some respects, some of this is sour grapes, you know, like it's that you know, these new efforts have stolen some of our digital thunder. And then I think in other respects, you know, it's that we don't believe in the way they're going about it. But I do think it is a separate thing. Although I think increasingly digital humanists are engaging with the newer MOOC efforts, and the newer MOOC efforts are engaging with the digital humanities community. Is that a fair assessment, guys?
Yeah, actually, Kathy Davidson, in her talk, much of which was about how MOOCs are extremely conservative pedagogically, you know, like that, you know, badly so. She said MOOCs are, in fact, the least disruptive thing to education that you could possibly imagine. You know, they don't at all take advantage of the webbiness of the web to make education better. They're a very old-fashioned model of education. After a great talk in which she said that, she then said, well, I'm going to teach a MOOC. So she's gonna try it out, and I mean, I think that the it probably does. If I were a better person, you know, I might get a bit more involved in trying to make sure that MOOCs were, right, you know,
fall,
what we would want them to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's also, it seems as though, again, particularly on the pedagogy side, research is a different thing. Even how you present digital humanities research to undergraduates is a different thing. But at the same time, it feels like this is coming. This is not some kind of weird thing at the outside. You know, Udacity has this pilot program at San Jose State. University of California, biggest university system in the country, in the world, is going to give credit for what are essentially MOOCs. It seems as though this is not necessary. It's something that feels dangerous to ignore.
Well, absolutely.
I heard a lot about it, just not on panels, but, you know, like over a drink, you know, that colleagues whose universities were starting to experiment with it. But I maybe felt the vaguest sense of things starting to turn from the MOOC mania of 2012 to something more like caution, not among faculty, but faculty saying that I think their provosts and deans had sort of started to realize that these things weren't making any money. And so they weren't, you know, whereas last year everyone was like diving in head first, they were being a little bit more tentative about what was going on at their university. So it's something I think will just be changing a little bit during 2013.
Yeah, and I think that the conversation, Dan, I think is changing. I think we'll probably talk about this next time around. But you know, one of the markers of that is this Bill of Rights. What is it? The Bill of Rights for online learning, which was co-authored by you know, Sebastian Thrun, you know, from Udacity, but also people like Kathy Davidson, who comes out of a more digital humanities orientation. So I think that these conversations are happening, and I think that the initial flurry of excitement is being tempered by some more realistic and more thoughtful stepping back. I don't want to spend too long on these issues because we do have another big story. I think it's probably the biggest story so far, really, I think, of the web in 2013 that we haven't talked about. And that's the tragedy of Aaron Swartz's suicide. And this is something that touches on a lot of the things we talk about on the Digital Campus podcast, in particular, issues of open access, but all kinds of things. And we're lucky to have Tim on today because Tim wrote what I said on Twitter was the best piece I've read about Swartz and his work and his death for The Verge. Tim, do you want to tell us a little bit about we've talked about Swartz on the show before, but do you want to tell us a little bit about, in our audience, a little bit about who Aaron Swartz was, what he did, and what he did to get him in trouble, and then ultimately we believe led to his suicide.
Sure. So Aaron Swartz was 26 years old at the time of his death, and he really spent about half of his life from the age of 13 in the public eye as somebody who was contributing, making serious contributions, not just as a kind of figurehead or a sort of rogue coder, but sitting on standards bodies for things like RSS and working on the semantic web and also being involved with startups. He was a co-founder, sort of the third person who came in to help co-found Reddit, for instance. And so you sort of so he had this, you know, really rich and broad tech background, totally way beyond, I think broader than maybe any other technology figure, and certainly broader and deeper than anyone at his age. The last couple of years, he's primarily been in the news for two things. So one was he was charged in a federal case for downloading large numbers of documents, JSTOR documents, on MIT's network. And at least what the evidence presented suggests is that he had access to MIT's library and MIT's network was open. He rigged up a laptop to and wrote a script to automatically download these PDFs. And it was never really clear exactly what he was going to do with them. The charge, again, was that he was going to make these freely available to the public and that this was a huge crime against JSTOR and would cost, you know, X millions of dollars if you paid for that access outright. But really what ended up happening is that he was prosecuted for sort of technical things in the way that the script accessed. So, it didn't use his full name. So he was really charged for something like wire fraud. And over the last, last year and a half since these charges came down, there have been different attempts at plea bargains. And ultimately, Aaron, who also suffered from depression, was looking at a possible charge of 35 years and really a minimum. Now it's sort of come out that the minimum that the federal government was offering was 6 months plus a guilty plea on all of the counts, which would have made him a felon and wouldn't have been able to vote depending on which state he was in and all sorts of different things, plus 6 months in federal prison. He committed suicide. He hung himself in New York a couple of weeks ago. So this in turn – He'd also been involved heavily in the fight against SOPA and PIPA, which is sort of part of his work as an activist against changes to copyright law. So this really, partly because of his notoriety, partly because of the manner of his death, partly because of concerns with the way the federal case was handled, Aaron had friends broad and deep throughout the technology industry and the startup communities and, really – he was a kind of nexus point for all of the scholarly communities, nexus point for all of these groups. And so there was, a real outpouring of grief and concern about his case, grief for his death and concern for his case. I think that more or less gets us to where we are.
Right. And I guess, I think putting aside the questions of whether he broke the law, which I don't know if any of us on the podcast are in a position to really say. I think the big questions for us, in this, and they're probably more than just this, but one of the big questions for me is, can we say whether, there are a lot of different groups involved, MIT, JSTOR, the federal prosecutors. How do we think people acquitted themselves? I think, there's been a lot of criticism of the prosecutor, but when it comes to the academic institutions, what do we know about how MIT and JSTOR handled this and how, their involvement in his prosecution and whether we think it was appropriate?
Well, JSTOR was involved in a limited way and very quickly said it wasn't interested in pursuing. And Aaron actually settled with JSTOR and MIT, but JSTOR wasn't interested in being involved with any kind of criminal case against Aaron. In fact, it went ahead and made some of its documents public almost immediately. The public domain documents that it had, which was charging for access to. So this is the sort of issue, is charging for access to documents that are in the public domain, was one of the issues that Aaron seemed to be concerned with in terms of JSTOR. And then, of course, recently the news has come out that they're going to make a number of its documents available in a limited way, a sort of metered way to the public. So JSTOR generally has been seen as acquitting itself very well. MIT, it's much more complicated. MIT was involved in turning over evidence to the federal government of its network requests without a warrant or a subpoena. Since Aaron's death, the president of MIT and Professor Hal Abelson, who's copyright advocate, has been leading an investigation to figure out what MIT's involvement in the case was, why and how those decisions were made, and whether or not anything could have been done differently. Because MIT has really faced a huge blowback both from both inside and outside the institution.
Other people on the call, is there a lesson in this? Is this just a tragic story about someone who kind of ran at the, I think, you know, sort of on the fringes of our circles. I think, you know, a number of us on the show probably have had contact with Aaron Swartz in various ways on Twitter, email, and at various times, because we're involved in open access issues and other kinds of technology issues. You know, that's kind of a person who is, you know, very much in our, we're very much aware of people, someone who we ran in similar circles. Is this just a sad story, or does this have lessons for us, for our work, for open access in the scholarly community, for how we manage our projects, our digital humanities projects, of which I think JSTOR really is certainly, you know, I would call it a digital humanities project of the first order. Does this have lessons for us, or is it really just a sad story?
I think, of course, it has lessons for us. It makes me glad to have been an open access proponent for a long time. My methods are, you know, I would venture to say our methods are probably open to being named terms like liberal or neoliberal, in the sense that they, you know, I tend to support open access in ways that are much less activist and much less, I suppose, dramatic than certainly Aaron Swartz's, working with institutions, writing letters to try to get laws changed, blogging, you know, however effective that may be, contributing to things like the EFF, just sort of taking stances that open access is a good thing. And certainly Dan and the center in general have been really instrumental in building tools that can facilitate open access and talking about new models for scholarly publishing. And those kinds of things are very dull and very boring when compared to more dramatic means of indicating one's support for this kind of principle. I really believe that we need both, that actually just laboring thanklessly in the trenches of law and policy and platform isn't enough. I don't think breaking oneself upon the wheel, as Aaron Swartz did, is enough either. I think you need both, and I'm glad to have been supporting in some small way the same kinds of things that Aaron did, even though I don't choose to emulate or even in all cases support his tactics.
I would only add to that I think that one of the things that this entirely awful set of circumstances makes clear is that we need some really very serious conversations to take place about the nature of property in the digital, what property is, whether things can ever actually be stolen, and what an appropriate means of redressing crimes against whatever property might constitute in the digital age might be. I mean, it's clear that a kind of a prosecutorial overreach is in effect in a lot of these kinds of cases. And I think, you know, one of the things that is really, I mean, insofar as there is a public good that will come out of this very private bit of awfulness, it is a very serious conversation that's going to be taking place in Congress and elsewhere over the next year, I would suspect, and probably ongoing after that, about what computer crimes are and how they ought to be understood in the context of the larger judicial system.
Yeah, I agree, Kathleen. I mean, one of the things, you know, I'm struck by in this is that, you know, the it seems like innovators of the kind that Aaron Swartz was, they always tend to kind of run at the fringes of what's acceptable, of what's you know, normal, of what's of even what's legal, And when the laws are interpreted or they're prosecuted in such a way that you know makes something like he did, which there was no victim. I mean, there really was no victim of the crime that he, if he did commit a crime, of the crime he was accused of. And you know, when it's prosecuted to the tune of 35 years in federal prison, I think we have to worry that it's going to stifle the kind of innovation that you know, and maybe the, you know, maybe the thing he was doing was wrong, and I tend to believe that the thing he was doing was wrong. But if it stifles the kind of personality that he was, that's not a good thing for our society. And so I think that those are really very important issues. And then the issues of property too. You know, one of the things we saw a lot of from skeptics of open access in the recent weeks has been analogies to you know, sort of bank robbery, where he was, you know, robbing a bank by downloading these articles, and those kinds of analogies I think are incredibly unhelpful, and they really really miss the point of the digital and what the digital, the affordances of the digital, and what digital goods are, and how they're shared and how they're used and how they're reproduced and what digital property looks like. So these, I agree, Kathleen, that these kinds of conversations are conversations we really need to have.
Yeah, I think the line from U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz, who is the head of the division that prosecuted Aaron, was stealing is stealing whether you use a computer or a crowbar. And I think, so just to back up a little bit. So the issue really with, and what he was charged for essentially, what drew MIT's attention first, just in the network management sense, was the fact that he was downloading a lot of articles. So again, it was automated script to download a lot of articles, which, as someone who had access to MIT's network, anyone on MIT's network could have downloaded, in principle, as many JSTOR articles as they want. So I think, and Aaron was interested in doing things like text mining those articles, trying to find out, you know, get sort of large scale data about scholarly knowledge. This is one of the things he was interested in with PACER, for example, which is the Library of Court Cases. Again, things in the public domain, not copyrightable, but that you know, that he had access to because of a free library program, and he wanted to create a kind of large scale database of these things, make them available to the public, and also find out, you know, who's suing who, what sort of, you know, really to do analytics on this set. And I think as people who are interested in scholarship, as people who are interested in doing these kind of computational, taking these kind of computational approaches to, you know, large databases of text, I think one of the issues that's raised is, which databases do you have access to? How much access do you have? If you act in a way that's irregular towards these databases, even if you technically have legal access to them, what is the response going to be? I mean, Aaron really, you know, we started talking a little bit about public humanities, and Aaron was, I think, in my opinion, a kind of public scholar, not just an activist, not just a very impressive coder, but somebody who really was invested in these kinds of questions of, you know, kind of understanding how knowledge works, and understanding it in not just a way that was about making political points, but also interested in it for its own sake. You know, it wasn't at all clear. Aaron was the sort of person who would download millions of JSTOR articles and read thousands of them. That's totally in keeping with who he was. And I knew him a little bit. I didn't know him nearly as well as many of my friends are. But I think all of these things, you know, people who work on university networks, people who run code on data sets, this is an issue connected with, again, with Kathleen's point about what is property in this sense? You know, if you have access to these documents, what kinds of access do you have? How is that access conditional? How is it absolute?
And people who are working at the fringe of new knowledge are always going to, I mean, by definition, they're going to transgress boundaries, and some of those boundaries may be listed in terms of service for these databases. Yeah, and exactly. We don't want the government coming down, I think, as hard as they did when those boundaries are transgressed. Any final thoughts on Swartz before we go?
Well, I mean, I would just say, Tom, that Tim, I so appreciated your article. I thought it was heartfelt and really, I think, got to Swartz's character too. And you know, I'd had some exchanges with him over the year about a variety of things, and Zotero being one of them. But you know, if you think about his life in full circle, you know, he really started out, I think, as a lot of us on the podcast are trying to do right now, to think about technologies that can really just ease the communication, not only among scholars, but between scholars and the public. I mean, RSS was really a method that, you know, sadly, had it really taken off, and I think it's certainly in decline. It's not gone, but so few people really use it compared to some of these other gated environments that I think it must have sort of chafed against his principles that he'd worked so hard. I mean, the stuff he wanted to help out on with Zotero was about open exchange of information and the technologies behind it. And as Tim pointed out, he really had a fully thought out and very smart political take and sort of ethical fiber of trying to get this done. And I think as he sort of went through life, he kept bumping up against all kinds of gates and hurdles. And I think it's a horrible, sad end, and also says something about, you know, how we should all, and I think just thinking back to the panel at the AHA, I think we should be working with those, you know, history journal editors to find ways, like the MLA is doing with the Commons, to find acceptable means to have open environments. And, you know, really, I think should make us think, all of us think about those kinds of issues.
Well, thanks, everybody. I think we can leave it there and invite everybody to join us next time when we reconvene for Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
Is that you typing, Tom?
Yeah, that's
that is Tom's awesome keyboard.
It is. It is. It sounds like it's the newsroom keyboard.